Good morning. As we did yesterday morning, we began by doing a short meditation, concentrating on the sensation of the air as it enters and leaves the nostrils with each breath. So what we need to do is to train our power of mindfulness. And mindfulness is the mental capacity to hold an object of attention. We often talk about the attention span of teenagers being very short, like a few seconds. It's not just teenagers, it's all of us. We have a very short attention span. So mindfulness is the solution to our inability to keep our mind focused upon any topic. In terms of learning any subject, whether it's Buddhist teachings or subject at school or university, we need mindfulness. We all have it to a limited degree, but particularly to be able to follow the teachings and explore the deeper meaning of the Buddhist teachings. It's essential to develop the wisdom, what we call the wisdom of meditation, which relies upon the power of mindfulness. So, although it may be boring to the mind just focusing on the breath, if we think of the ultimate purpose is to have this, to strengthen our quality of mindfulness, then that will benefit not only ourselves, but those who depend upon us. As we mentioned yesterday, that if we can't subdue our own uncontrolled mind, then it's very difficult to help those who depend upon us for their security, for their protection, for their guidance in life. And not just guidance in a spiritual sense, but it's how to, you know, our children, our parents, our partners, our friends, constantly need help to overcome the unwanted obstacles that arise in life. And it's one of the best ways of helping is just to remain calm, to remain peaceful when others come to us with their apparent disasters. If we are quiet, calm, and especially if we are affectionate and loving and understanding, there's probably no better treatment, no better help that we can give to others. We can't resolve their immediate problems, but we can provide an alternative to their reaction of disaster. You know, they think the world's coming to an end for them. So, as you're watching the breath, be conscious. I am training my mind in mindfulness, holding the object, and stay with the breath. The slightest thought comes in, push it away. It takes energy. Eventually, it becomes effortless. But in the beginning, we need effort to hold our mind focused on the object as we train in mindfulness. So first, just make sure your physical posture is comfortable, back straight. Then focus your whole attention on the coming and going of the breath at your nostrils. Now, consciously generate your mind in the aspect of perfect motivation to engage in the activity of discussing Dharma this morning. First, think of your Dharma teacher who introduced you to the Buddha's teachings and the kindness of all of the teachers who have maintained the living tradition of the Dharma since the time of Shakyamuni Buddha. Feel that your mind is manifesting the aspect of refuge in the three jewels. The meaning of which is that you have confidence in an inner direction of how to lead your life. Confidence that creating virtue and abandoning non-virtue is a skillful way to live and to die. Opposing the self-centered ignorance with its attachment and aversion that is the root of all suffering. Then think that all other beings are just like you, merely seeking happiness and freedom from suffering, but not knowing the real causes of happiness and suffering. We blindly hurt ourselves and others. So generate the thought that I am going to guide all other beings out of suffering by finding the path myself in my mind. And when I do that, I will be qualified to show others the way out. To achieve that, I'm going to engage in listening and thinking about the meaning of the Buddha's teachings. Then you can relax and stop the meditation. Okay, so yesterday we talked in some detail about the nature of the mind, about the three main realms of rebirth within the wheel of life, and then we had a short introduction into the Buddha's presentation of the cyclic nature of existence in terms of the four great periods, of probably referring to solar systems, periods of emptiness, period of creation, period of abiding, and the period of destruction. So these four periods indicate the existence of, let's say, our group of sentient beings associated with our solar system in our galaxy. It's not that we always stay in the same group. Since beginningless time, according to different individual karma, then mind streams migrate throughout the universe where there are similar cycles of emptiness, creation, abiding, and destruction happening at different phases, different times. Like as some world systems are being destroyed, others are being created, and sentient beings are being reborn. So life as we know it is quite similar throughout the universe. It's not that there are little green men with eyes on stalks or something on other planets. There is a commonality in the types of rebirth throughout the universe. Even in the Abhidhamma, it says that most languages spoken throughout the universe are that the roots of the language are the roots of Sanskrit. It's like the universal language. So if the aliens ever come, then if you want to communicate, you should learn Sanskrit. That's just an interesting point that I've read. So, yesterday evening or afternoon, I mentioned that this period of emptiness is the period that after the cessation of a world system, when they're in the particular region of space, there's just like gas or dust, or as the Dalai Lama calls them, space particles. For a very, very long time, and the sentient beings in that region are all in the form and formless realm, rebirth. After a long period of time, the karma for that experience begins to wear out, and so that as they start dying, then they get reborn in lower realms. And the first one is that they get reborn in the first form realm concentration, the realm of Brahma. The sign that that's happening is that this wind starts to blow and move the space particles, and so they start to aggregate, come together. And so one enters the period of creation, and that takes an equally long time as a period of emptiness, and the creation of the more gross environments as a result of the karma of those sentient beings. So it's the collective karma which causes the evolution of stars and planets and so on, the coarse environments for desire realm existence. During this period of creation, then all of the realms are established, and at the end there is all the environments and the rebirth states are happening. So we come to the beginning of the period of abiding. There's a graph that I've made up from the teachings I received. Page 7. So, at the very beginning of the period of abiding, there are human beings, but they're nothing like ourselves. The human beings have bodies of light. They're spontaneously born, and like we would call them, gods. They don't partake of any physical food, or they simply survive on the power of concentration and great bliss. Their lifespan is incredibly long. I think 80,000 years at the very beginning. So we wouldn't recognize them as humans, but that's the way it's presented in the Buddha's teachings. Simultaneously with the existence of these ethereal beings, there is the evolution of animal life as we observe, or we have observed through fossil evidence and so on, and the present types of animals. So, as I mentioned in the notes, the biological theory that life began in a primordial soup of organic compounds where things started to come together and reproduce is quite compatible with the Buddha's teachings, that you have this physical development, and from those very, very early forms of life could have gone in two directions. One, which purely through the power of chemical activity, these primitive organisms evolved towards the whole plant world, the world of plants, which in Buddhist teaching there is no mind directly associated with the bodies of plants. Simultaneously, it's quite, acceptable from my point of view, that as these organisms became more complicated, they became suitable supports for consciousness. And so the mind, the pre-existing mind streams of beings who were dying from karma, connected with these supports of consciousness. And so there, from that very primitive beginning, you have the whole evolution of the animal and the human kingdom, or kingdoms. As time passed, and we theorize from the fossil evidence that there appeared the different types of animals, amphibians, reptiles, mammals, etc. And then there are ape-like creatures, and there seems from the evidence there's a whole spectrum of these ape-like creatures where becoming more and more like our type of human, Homo sapiens, which we accept to be our species. So whether one would say that, oh no, this is an animal, that's a human, from the Buddha's point of view, it's just purely a matter of terminology. Their minds were, all animals' minds have the whole potential that our mind manifests. The only limitation is in the degree of complexity of the nervous system and the brain. I often use the a thought experiment. Einstein was famous for his thought experiments. So, my thought experiment, if you transplant a human mind into the brain of a rabbit, that human mind can only function at the level of a rabbit's mind because of the supporting condition, than the brain. Whereas if you transplant a rabbit's mind into a human brain, that rabbit's mind can now function as a human mind because of its support, the human brain. So, in other words, animals don't have inferior minds to humans. They have equal minds, but limited capacity to express their potential. The same in humans. I mean, if we can be perfectly normal, then we can have a brain injury, and we can no longer function. You know, our capacity for our mind to function is limited by the type and the degree of injury to our brain. You know, Alzheimer's is a very clear example that with age, with degeneration of the physical capacity of the mind to function, perfectly intelligent humans become like little children, losing memory, losing capacity to emote, losing capacity to interact at social levels. It's not that the mind itself is impaired or damaged. Mind is non-physical, but its support, the brain, is no longer capable of allowing those mental functions to manifest. So, going back to the evolution of species and so on, then at the beginning of the period of abiding, the only humans were these with bodies of light and amazing capacities of clairvoyance and so on. And it says the lifespan was 80,000 years, incredibly long. So they would live and they would die within that period. They did not partake of food, or they were born spontaneously, so that there was no birth from a womb. Correspondingly, there was the evolution of the coarser animals. And then there's a point where we would say Homo sapiens has developed, and these are humans from our present day viewpoint. We're the only humans, bodies and minds like ours. I mentioned in the notes that, well, where's the fossil evidence of these bodies, humans with bodies of light? Well, bodies of light don't leave fossils, if you think about it. So, now, our Earth today, we're at the very beginning of a period of abiding. In the graph, you can see that a period of abiding is divided up into 20 equal periods. They're called lesser periods or lesser eons, whatever you want to call them. They are of equal duration. And our Earth is now at this very first period. We're in the middle or towards the end of this very first period. So, at some point, as the humans with incredibly long lifespans began to, their karma changed, the lifespan became shorter and shorter. And this is because they were experiencing the time of the five degenerations. So the five degenerations are still happening. In fact, they're getting stronger. They're on page six. So the first is that the average lifespan decreases. So it's going down. It's said that at the time of Buddha, 2,500 years ago, the average lifespan was a human was about 100. Today, maybe it's 80 years. So the lifespan is decreasing. That's the first degeneration. The second is the times begin to degenerate. Food becomes more scarce, of inferior quality. And within society, there is increasing violence and disharmony, not just in society in general, but in families, between different groups of people and between nations. The third is that the disturbing emotions of anger and hatred, of desire, pride, attachment, become stronger this is in general in the minds of human beings. The fourth is that people hold very strongly to mistaken views, wrong views about life. They deny karmic cause and effect. They or have distorted versions of karmic cause and effect. They see no distant responsibility of our actions. And the fifth is that gradually the human form, the human body becomes more gross, becomes short in stature, ugly, weak, and human minds becoming feeble. So, this has been happening in general since the beginning of the period of abiding on our earth. And we can look at our own society and look at societies in general. We suppose, well, but look, lifespan's getting longer. In the last, century or so, due to the better food, better medicines, and so on, it seems that lifespan's getting longer. But the Buddhist teachings are that we're all born with a karmically determined lifespan. When the karmically determined lifespan is up, nothing can stop death. We will die. But we could die before, due to environmental circumstances, due to stupid behavior, putting ourselves in dangerous situations. We could die before our karmic lifespan is up. So, although the average karmic lifespan, say at the time of Buddha, may have been 100, the actual lifespan of human beings 2,500 years ago was shorter, because people weren't able to live out their full lifespan. So it's said that as during this degenerate period, the Buddhas appear to turn the wheel of Dharma during the period of degeneration. Because when things are going from good to bad, then people are asking questions. People want to know why. So far in this world, there have been four Buddhas who have appeared to turn the wheel of Dharma. I'm not sure if I mentioned the durations, but the first appeared when the lifespan was something like 20,000 years. And then less. That Buddha's teachings were given and they disappeared. And the second Buddha, so the first was the Buddha Kakutsunda. The second was Buddha Kanakamuni. The third was Buddha Kasyapa, and the fourth was Buddha Shakyamuni. So we still live at a time when Buddha Shakyamuni, Buddha's teachings, are being practiced and realizations are being achieved by practitioners, but not many. It's getting harder and harder. As Shakyamuni Buddha himself said before he manifested Parinirvana, He said, my teachings will last over 10 periods of 500 years. So 5,000 years. During the first 500 years, many people will achieve liberation and enlightenment. The second 500 years, less, but people will achieve levels of the path. The third, even less. The fourth, even less. And we're in the fourth period of 500 years. The last period, he said, my teachings will only be present in books, but nobody will understand the meaning of the books. And prior to that, there will be books and very little understanding. So you see, we are actually at a time when Shakyamuni Buddha's teachings are disappearing from our human society. Incredibly rare to meet a qualified teacher. Incredibly rare to be able to understand what the qualified teacher is saying. And even more rare to have the will, the strength, the courage and determination to put those teachings into practice. Because our society is becoming more and more self-centered, more and more busy. Mere survival is becoming the predominant factor in living. And we're bombarded with mistaken views, different views. Even within Buddhism, there are different groups who disagree with each other, debate, attack. As Buddha said, he said, my teachings will gradually degenerate and they will be degenerated from inside by the practitioners themselves who will gain mistaken understanding of the meaning of the teachings, but they will believe that their mistaken understanding is correct, and so they will fight verbally, intellectually, even physically. There will be conflict within the Sangha, the practitioners of Buddha's teachings, and that they will disappear. So this is all predicted. And it's not just Buddhism. You can see in every philosophical system, every major religion in human history has begun in a very apparently pure manner for the benefit of all. But factions have arisen within, and people have started, you know, killing other human beings in the name of God, in the name of their religion. This is reality. So it's happening. Buddha said it's going to happen in Buddhism. This is because of the five degenerations. The wrong views are getting stronger and stronger and stronger. People might believe, but no, my view is correct. This is what Buddha said. This is the right way to live. But that belief is mistaken. So we have to be aware that it's happening. Not become antagonistic. Not take up arms to defend. Oh, I am Gelugpa. I am Lama Tsongkhapa. You know, that's not the way. We have to not be turned off our spiritual path, because Buddha's teachings are for each individual, showing us how to live our life according to our understanding of the Dharma. Anyway, this is happening, and Buddha said it would happen. As Buddha said it would happen. So this first period in the graph, from 0 to 1, is the first of the 20 lesser periods of time. And you see, it's called the period of the long descent in lifespan. It will end when the average human lifespan will be 10 years old. And so during those 10 years, humans will mature, they will breed, and they will average die at 10 years old. And actually, this is happening. Humans throughout the world, children are becoming sexually mature, younger and younger and younger. And there are cases of children 7, 8, 9 years old having babies. So, I mean, it's not inconceivable. That's my point. So, during this period of long descent, it'll bottom out at the end of this first of the 20 periods, and it said there'll be great calamity in human society. There'll be war, there'll be famine, disease, and there'll be mutual destruction. Be a terrible war, or wars. We're not going to kill everybody. The survivors will flee to the mountains or somewhere else. And then they'll come back to the destroyed cities. And they'll just be looking around, what have we done? This is happening on a global scale. At that time, it's predicted that Maitreya Buddha, who is the future Buddha, Maitreya Buddha is presently teaching in the Tushita Pure Land, which is associated, but not exactly the same, as Tushita Heaven, one of the desire realm, sky-dwelling heavens. So that's where Maitreya Buddha is now teaching as a Sambhogakaya, Nimittikaya, as a Buddha. So Maitreya Buddha will appear on the earth as a bodhisattva. He'll have a very tall body, because remember the stature of human body is getting shorter and the body is becoming ugly. So Maitreya will be tall and incredibly attractive. And that will attract people, and he will teach morality. He won't teach the whole Dharma, just karmic cause and effect. Fundamental, avoiding harmfulness. And people, humans in general, will start to observe morality. And as a result, collectively, over time, things, the five degenerations will be reversed and things will get better. Lifespan will increase, the food, etc. will get better, conflict will get less, wrong views will get less. And so, at that point, human society on our earth will have entered the second of the 20 periods in this long period of abiding. And you can see on the graph, the lifespan will go up again to very high. It'll reach a point, and then it's going to go down again. Why? This is the karma of ignorance, the karma of sentient beings. Things will get better and better, but then out. Karmically, will the humans still carry the seeds of ignorance, still carry the seeds of pride and jealousy and anger and so on. These disturbing emotions will manifest, and the five degenerations will begin again in the middle of this second period. Now, Maitreya will not appear as the next wheel-turning Buddha during that period of increasing lifespan, because things are getting better and better. And people won't listen. I think, hey, life is wonderful. There is no suffering. It's just going better all the time. A Buddha, any Buddha, could only be effective when things are going from good to worse. And people are starting, wow, they want to know some answers. So it said the Maitreya Buddha will appear during this, again, this period of descending lifespan as the five degenerations start again. At some time, during that period of descent. So Maitreya will be the fifth wheel-turning Buddha. And during the duration of our Earth, during subsequent cycles, the third, fourth, fifth, sixth, there are going to be 1,000 wheel-turning Buddhas. The 1,000 arms on Avalokiteshvara symbolize the 1,000 wheel-turning Buddhas who will appear during times of degeneration throughout these 20 cycles of our Earth, the period of abiding of our Earth. There are some worlds where all planets where you have life like ours throughout the universe, they all go through the four cycles, the four big periods, emptiness, creation, abiding, degeneration. But there are some worlds where during the entire period of abiding, no wheel-turning Buddha will appear because of the collective karma of the humans. There will still be cycles. There will still be bodhisattvas. There will still be practice of morality, and so things getting better, and then degeneration. But there won't be a wheel-turning Buddha who will teach the entire Dharma, indicating how individuals can achieve nirvana, liberation, and enlightenment. Not because the Buddhas can't teach it, it's because the humans in those planets at that time won't have the collective karma to receive the teachings. Of course, individual humans can be die from that particular world and be reborn in another planet in the galaxy where there is a wheel-turning Buddha. So it's all, we cannot say, no chance, you lot of hopeless individuals can migrate according to their karma throughout the universe. There can be times when in a planet a few Buddhas, not 1,000, but a few or many, the maximum is like 1,000. Our Earth is said to be experiencing a fortunate period, of a very fortunate period of abiding, where 1,000 Buddhas will appear and turn the wheel of Dharma. Still, they won't all teach the whole Dharma. Shakyamuni Buddha was the first of the four to teach Tantra, the Vajrayana. Again, not that the others couldn't, but the humans weren't receptive to the Vajrayana. So Shakyamuni Buddha taught the whole, the Hinayana, the Mahayana, including the Vajrayana. The 11th Buddha, the 11th wheel-turning Buddha, will also teach Vajrayana. And that will be the mind stream that was, that we call Lama Tsongkhapa. Lama Tsongkhapa is now a Buddha teaching Dharma in a pure land, the Sambhogakaya. So that mind stream will manifest as the 11th wheel-turning Buddha on this earth and teach the Vajrayana. Then none of the remaining 990 Buddhas or something like that, none of them will teach Vajrayana until the very last, the 1,000th, who will summarize all the teachings. So only three of the 1,000 Buddhas will actually teach the Vajrayana. Think about that. How rare it is to receive the Vajrayana teachings, and how important it is, because actually, ultimately, in the Mahayana path, one generates bodhicitta, and the sutra path. But to actually achieve Buddhahood, one needs, an individual needs the Vajrayana practice in order to overcome the illusory appearance of the subtle visions as the mind becomes more and more subtle. And so that can only be achieved through tantric practice. Again, it doesn't mean that the humans who receive the teachings from those thousand Buddhas can't, if they miss out on Shakyamuni Buddha, the 11th Buddha, and the 1000th Buddha, doesn't mean they can't achieve Buddhahood. Because, as we've mentioned, they can be reborn elsewhere. They can go to pure lands. And in the pure lands, they can receive, which aren't samsara, the pure lands aren't part of the wheel of life. So they can create the merit as Arya Bodhisattvas, be reborn in a pure land, receive the tantric teachings and achieve enlightenment. So, this just gives us a hint of the complexity of life as explained by Buddha. And this table, these periods, are to give us a general idea. So our earth will cycle through 19 of these short periods, and then at the end of the 19th, it's the beginning of the 20th. If you see on the graph, there's no up and down. This is called the period of progressive increase. So what happens is that beings will practice Dharma, they'll practice morality from that nadir, from that lowest point, and they'll collectively, their karma will get better and better, and their lifespan, the human lifespan, will get longer and longer, and progressively, as they die, they'll be reborn in higher realms, as the devas, the desire realm devas, as form realm devas, and formless realm devas. So, at the end of that 20th cycle, on our earth, in this region, humans, or that the hell rebirth will cease, because the humans will be being born higher and higher, and there won't be any hell existence or experience on this earth, and that will be the end of the period of abiding, and that will be the end. That will be the beginning of the period of destruction. So hell rebirth stops. Hell environments don't exist. Hungry ghost rebirth stops. No hungry ghost environment. Animal, human, the desire realm gods who live on the earth, the four great kings, the heaven of 33, all gradually stop, and the sentient beings are being higher and higher, up into the form, the formless realm. And so, towards the end of that period of the cessation of the environments, it's taught that the sun will expand and will completely burn up. The fire at the end of the aeon will consume the environments as we know them. And so, if we haven't achieved liberation and enlightenment, we would be being born higher and higher, but still in the wheel of life. And so, at the end of that, there was just, once again, the entire solar system will be dust, or the galaxy, I'm not sure, probably the solar system. And there'll be another period of emptiness, whilst all the human, sentient beings, are in the form and formless realm, the long, long, long period. And then the karma will begin to generate, and it'll start all over again. So that is the presentation of the cycle of the universe. Before we move on, do you have any discussion about that? This is the teaching I received from Geshe Champa Techo at the Lhasa Monastery. Yeah. When? How does the pure land fit in? Well, so the bodhicitta is the cause of, the primary cause of Buddhahood. Right? And bodhicitta is the altruistic determination to release all beings from suffering. And so through bodhicitta, the bodhisattva accumulates vast merit on the path. And through practice, accumulates vast wisdom. So, the attainment of Buddhahood is achieved with the completion of the two accumulations of wisdom and of merit. The accumulation of wisdom is the primary cause for the attaining the Dharmakaya, the omniscient wisdom mind of Buddhahood. The accumulation of merit is the primary cause primary cause for attainment of the body, the physical body of a Buddha. So the physical body has two aspects. There's what we call the bliss body or the enjoyment body, the Sambhogakaya. The secondary cause for the Sambhogakaya is the accumulation of wisdom. And the secondary cause for the Dharmakaya, the omniscient mind of Buddhahood, is accumulation of merit. Yes, so it's primary and secondary operating. The Sambhogakaya aspect of the Buddha, you see with the crowns and the ornaments, you know, very detailed appearance. Simultaneously, due to that accumulation of merit, each Buddha creates his or her pure land, an environment where Arya bodhisattvas can be not reborn through karma, but reborn through the accumulation of merit and prayer. They can be reborn there, and the Buddha in the Sambhogakaya aspect teaches the Dharma, and they can achieve enlightenment in that pure land. That's Arya bodhisattvas, means bodhisattvas who have realized emptiness. But they're also, you directly realized emptiness. But there are also other beings who have not directly realized emptiness. They may be bodhisattvas, even practitioners who are not bodhisattvas on Hinayana path. So, depending upon their individual aspirations, their individual capacities, in order to help them, Buddhas appear in the Nimanakaya. Nimanakaya means emanation body. So there are Nimanakaya pure lands, such as the Western Pure Land of Amitabha. You don't have to be an Arya Bodhisattva to be reborn in Amitabha's Western Pure Land. You don't have to be an Arya, you don't have to realize emptiness. So, for those individuals who have a great deal of merit, but haven't realized emptiness, Amitabha, in great compassion, created pure land. But, so, technically, these are said to be at the level of the fourth concentration, the fourth form role, dhyana, or concentration. But they're not in the will of life. These pure lands. You're not born there by impure karma, you're born there through the accumulation of merit and through prayer. Tishita Pure Land, where Maitreya Buddha is at the moment, is another example of an ordinary pure land where non-Aryas can be reborn. So, in these pure lands, one receives the teachings and one can gain realizations of emptiness, one can gain more merit. And through choice, one can choose to be born as a human, not through the ripening of ordinary karma, but through great compassion, great love, to work for sentient beings and to accumulate merit. So, that's very briefly how the Pure Lands fit in. So the question is to elaborate on the different levels of practice, the lesser vehicle, the Hinayana, the great vehicle, Mahayana, and the Vajrayana, which is part of... Right. Sure. Well, of course, Buddha taught all levels. And in general, to the groups of people that Buddha taught in India at the time, there are those whose general capacity was just to seek liberation, nirvana, the lesser vehicle. Then there are those whose capacity was greater, and Buddha taught the Mahayana, the Bodhisattva's vehicle. Then there were those whose capacities were very rare, who were capable of receiving the Vajrayana teaching. So Buddha manifesting as Vajradhara, not as the ordinary aspect of Shakyamuni, but as Vajradhara, taught the Vajrayana. So this is in general. Now, amongst those, the group who were inclined towards the Nirvana, the personal liberation, there's a spectrum. And there are individuals who are very close to generating the Mahayana attitude, the altruistic thought to achieve enlightenment for others. And quite so, they could generate bodhicitta. Instead of entering nirvana, they achieve great realizations and they generate bodhicitta, and so they enter Mahayana path. And similarly, with those who receive the Mahayana teachings in general, there were those who were aspiring to achieve enlightenment, but they weren't all capable of understanding and practicing the Vajrayana. But some of those, as they their mind developed on the path, they became more and more capable, and so were able to receive the Vajrayana teachings. Now, to actually achieve Buddhahood, to achieve nirvana, we have to abandon the obscurations to liberation. So that is the afflictions, ignorance, anger, attachment, and so on, and their seeds. And in the process, we will destroy karma created by those disturbing minds. To achieve Buddhahood, one has to abandon those obscurations to liberation, but one also has to abandon the obscurations to omniscience, the obscurations to all knowing. So a Hinayana practitioner achieves nirvana. They have achieved the obscurations in their mind to liberation, but they still have the non-afflictive obscurations to omniscience. This doesn't prevent them from achieving nirvana, but it prevents them from achieving Buddhahood. They will remain, in general, in blissful nirvana for eons of time until a Buddha will recognize that their minds are ripe and will awaken them from their samadhi, will say, your suffering has come to an end, But suffering still exists in the world. And instantaneously, this realization will come and they'll generate bodhicitta and they'll enter the bodhisattva's path. So there is only one final vehicle, and that's Buddhahood. Now, the Vajrayana contains the method, the teachings are not different from the Sutrayana, the general Mahayana teachings. The difference is the method of being able to awaken the subtle experiences of mind through causing the winds to enter the central channel, the central psychic channel. This is what is unique about the Vajrayana. It has this particular method. So the most subtle obscurations to omniscience are associated with the subtle visions of the winds that occur when the winds are in the central channel. Those visions still appear to exist inherently. And that is the most subtle obscuration to omniscience. To eliminate that most subtle obscuration to omniscience, one has to generate the vision through the tantric practice. Then one has to recognize this subtle appearance of inherent existence of those subtle visions. And then one extinguishes that subtle appearance through incredibly powerful meditation on emptiness. The direct realization of emptiness is the true path. That is the path which destroys the obscurations to liberation and it destroys the obscurations to omniscience. So even a bodhisattva who follows just the sutra path, like Shakyamuni Buddha demonstrated. Shakyamuni Buddha, in his life, you know, the 12 activities of his life, he demonstrated the attainment of enlightenment under the Bodhi tree in Bodh Gaya. So it's taught, as Geshe-Jumbo Chetok taught, that without any overt Vajrayana practice, when Buddha sat beneath the Bodhi tree and his mind entered the more and more subtle levels, in the Samadhi, Manjushri appeared to Buddha, you know, Manjushri, the embodiment of wisdom, gave empowerment to Shakyamuni Buddha's mind. And so in that same evening, like evening, midnight, morning, as Buddha was under the Bodhi tree, Shakyamuni Buddha brought an end to the subtle appearance of inherent existence of those subtle visions and achieved Buddhahood. It is only through the Vajrayana that one can do that, because it's only through the Vajrayana that one can manifest these subtle visions of the winds in the central channel. So that's why any individual needs to eventually practice Vajrayana to actually achieve Buddhahood. Yeah. Sorry, I'm...
During the last few months of the you said that all the sanctioned beings will go for higher and higher levels. But if the sanctioned beings still have karmas of being born in the hell, you will still be born in the hell.
Yeah. So during this last, the 20th period, as things are getting better, and hell environments are ceasing because rebirth is not happening. Yes, the sentient beings, even though they're being born higher and higher, they still carry karmic potentials to be born in the hells. But the strongest potentials are to be born in higher and higher places. So even they're in the form and formless realm, gods, no gross suffering at all, still at those levels, they do carry karmic potencies to be born in all six realms of samsara. Yeah.
The material of this 30 intervals, right? How does this compare to the 3,000
eons? So I didn't quite catch. I'm going deaf. It's another sign of old age, degeneration.
They say 3,000 eons.
Three countless.
What perspective with respect to
each? Okay. The three
countless.
I see. We say on the sutra path it takes a bodhisattva at three countless great eons to achieve the goal of enlightenment. A countless great eon is much, much longer than these eons in this graph. I can't remember the figures, I had it somewhere. But it is much longer to follow the Bodhisattva's path. And also, three countless great eons is the shortest time. It can take longer, but that's the shortest. It is incredibly long. We might think, well, what hope have we got? Well, I think it was Pabonka Rinpoche in Liberation of the Palm of the Hand. I think he says that it takes much, much longer than three countless great eons to get out of the three lower realms and be born human. So, we've been in those three lower realms, which means that our path is almost finished, even if we're just beginning the Bodhisattva's path. Because we have been animals, hungry ghosts and hell beings for an unbelievably long time. And now we're human. I mean, we are so fortunate to be human. We don't realize the prayer, the pure morality, the generosity, you know, all of the perfections we have practiced so strongly to be where we are now today. This human body, and in a situation of having met the Mahayana teachings, qualified teachers, and to be able to discuss Dhamma as we are this morning. We're nearly there. And what a tragedy if we waste it. What a terrible tragedy if we allow selfishness, anger, attachment, pride to dominate our mind. It will all be wasted. Think about that. Now, we're going to go from this point now, after lunch, into a deeper investigation of the mind. There'll be some more notes, a few more pages. I'm sure you've had these teachings before on the minds and the 51 mental factors, but just to help you, there are a few pages explaining the 51 mental factors and the major minds. So that topic will be discussed this afternoon, and I think that they're printing out the pages now, or the file will be available if you want to have it on your screen. The last page, page 10 here, there's just a presentation of the three levels of knowledge. So there's the knowledge of listening and observing. This refers to valid information that we gain from our observations, from hearing the teachings and reading books. So this initial knowledge is correct, but it's just at a level of belief. We believe it and it happens to be true. But belief is good. It's a necessary precursor to really understanding. But we can be talked out of our belief by somebody with a clever but distorted mind. So belief is good beginning, but we need more. And that's the second one, the knowledge of analysis. So this knowledge is through logic. We logically question and investigate the teachings. And when we can see that something is true, not just because the book says it's true, but we understand the logical signs which prove it's true, then we gain the inferential, intellectual understanding that's unshakable, because we know the logics that establish this as fact. So nobody can talk us out of it. That's good, but that itself is not enough. If we're referring to emptiness, you know, the understanding of emptiness, the intellectual, inferential knowledge of emptiness is not powerful enough to eradicate the innate self-grasping ignorance, which is the root of our problems. We need to improve our knowledge to the third level, the knowledge of meditation. And this is where, through the power of calm abiding and a higher seeing, or vipassana is wisdom born on the mind of pure concentration, calm abiding, insight wisdom. Then our intellectual understanding becomes direct experience. Mental consciousness has direct experience of emptiness, where emptiness appears to the mind not through the means of a mental image. Remember yesterday there was a theory, what about concepts? Are concepts permanent? Well, yes, a conception is mind, and mind is impermanent. But a concept is something which a conception has, the idea. And the idea is a mental picture of what it is that what we conceive, what we understand. That's the concept. That mental picture does not change moment by moment. It's not mind. It is the appearance of our idea of reality. But there is an element of confusion in that conception confuses our idea of reality with reality itself. So we need the knowledge of meditation to get rid of that form of duality. So direct experience of emptiness, as our example, is as it says, it's direct. It's not indirect. It's not knowledge depending upon an idea of the object. It is direct experience of the object. That wisdom, that knowledge, is the antidote to self-grasping ignorance. That is the true path. which destroys ignorance and all of the afflictions. It doesn't happen all at once. When we first generate that wisdom, we just destroy forever our intellectual misconceptions. But we still have the innate misconceptions. And they have to be progressively eliminated by the same wisdom, the same direct realization of emptiness, but supported by a mind which has greater power of concentration. So concentration can vary in power, subjective power. And to get rid of the more subtle, innate afflictions, we need the, not only the power of concentration, but we need the power of accumulation of merit. And this is where the three countless great eons come in. Accumulating more and more merit. Okay, so have a break and we'll meet after lunch. Thank you.